Strangely, neither man sounded the least uneasy over laying hands on an Aes Sedai, and the Aiel man apparently had done so fully aware of what she was. Even if he was a renegade Shido, he had to be ignorant of the fact that she could not channel without permission. Only Savannah and a handful of the wise ones knew that. This was all growing more confusing by the moment. Suddenly she was lifted into the air and laid on her belly. Across her own saddle, she realized, and the next moment she was bouncing on the hard leather, one of the men using a hand to keep her from falling as the mare began to trot. "Let us go to where you can make us one of your holes, Phaedra Niald."
"Just the other side of the slope, Gaul. Why, I've been here so often I can make a gateway nearly anywhere at all. Do you, Aiel, run everywhere?"
A gateway? What was the man blathering about? Dismissing his nonsense, she considered her options and found none good. Bound like a lamb for market, gagged so she would not be heard 10 paces away if she shrieked her lungs out, her chances of escape were non-existent, unless some of the Shido sentries intercepted her captors. But did she want them to? Unless she reached Ebara, she had no way to stop him from ruining everything. On the other hand, how many days off did his camp lie? He could not be very near, or the Shido would have found him by now. She knew scouts had been making sweeps as far as 10 miles from the camp. However many days were required to reach him, it would take as many to return. Not merely minutes late, but days late. Tharava would not kill her for it, just make her wish she were dead. She could explain. A tale of being captured by brigands. No, just a pair. It was hard enough to believe 2 men had gotten this near the encampment, much less a band of brigands. Unable to channel, she had needed time to escape. She could make the tale convincing. It might persuade Tharava. If she said, it was useless. The first time Tharava had punished her for being late, it had been because her cinch broke and she had had to walk back leading her horse. The woman had not accepted that excuse, and she would not accept being kidnapped either. Galena wanted to weep. In fact, she realized that she was weeping, hopeless tears she was helpless to stop. The horse halted, and before she could think, she convulsed wildly, trying to fling herself off the saddle, screaming as loudly as her gag permitted. They had to be trying to avoid sentries. Surely Tharava would understand if the sentries returned with her and her captors, even if she was late. Surely she could find a way to handle Fael, even with her husband dead. A hard hand smacked her rudely.
"Be silent," the Aiel man said, and they began to trot again.
Her tears began again, too, and the silk cowl covering her face grew damp. Tharava was going to make her howl. But even while she wept, she began to work on what she would say to Ebara. At least she could salvage her chances of obtaining the rod. Tharava was going to...
No. No!
She needed to concentrate on what she could do. Images of the cruel-eyed wise one holding a switch or a strap or binding cords reared in her mind, but every time she forced them down while she went over every question Ebara might ask and what answers she would give him, on what she would say to make him leave his wife's safety in her hands. In none of her calculations had she expected to be lifted down and stood upright no more than an hour after being captured.
"Unsaddle her horse, Norrin, and picket it with the others," the Mirandian said. "Right away, Master Niald," came a reply, in a Kyrianan accent.
The bonds around her ankles fell away. A knife blade slid between her wrists, severing those cords, and then whatever held her gag in place was untied. She spat out silk sodden with her own saliva and jerked the cowl back. A short man in a dark coat was leading Swift away through a straggle of large, patched brown tents and small, crude huts that seemed made from tree branches, including pine boughs with brown needles. How long for pine to turn brown? Days, surely, perhaps weeks. The 60 or 70 men tending cook fires or sitting on wooden stools looked like farmers in their rough coats. But some were sharpening swords, and spears and halberds and other pole arms stood stacked in 12 places. Through the gaps between the tents and huts, she could see more men moving about to either side, a number of them in helmets and breastplates, mounted and carrying long, streamered lances. Soldiers, riding out on patrol. How many more lay beyond her sight? No matter. What was in front of her eyes was impossible. The Shido had sentries farther from their camp than this. She was certain they did.
"If the face wasn't enough," Niald murmured, "that cool, calculating study would convince me. Like she's examining worms under a rock she's turned over."
A weedy fellow in a black coat, he knuckled his waxed moustaches in an amused way, careful not to spoil the points. He wore a sword, but he certainly had no look of soldier or armsman about him.
"Well, come along then, Aes Sedai," he said, clasping her upper arm. "Lord Perrin will be wanting to ask you some questions."
She jerked free, and he calmly took a firmer grip.
"None of that now."
The huge Aiel man, Gaul, took her other arm, and she could go with them or be dragged. She walked with her head high, pretending they were merely an escort, but anyone who saw how they held her arms would know differently. Staring straight ahead, she was still aware of armed farm boys. Most were young, staring at her. Not gaping in astonishment, just watching, considering. How could they be so high-handed with an Aes Sedai? Some of the wise ones who were unaware of the oath holding her had begun expressing doubt that she was Aes Sedai because she obeyed so readily and truckled so for Sarava. But these two knew what she was and did not care. She suspected those farmers knew, too, and yet none displayed any surprise at how she was being treated. It made the back of her neck prickle. As they approached a large red-and-white striped tent with the door flaps tied back, she overheard voices from inside.
"Said he was ready to come right now," a man was saying. "I can't afford to feed one more mouth when I don't know for how long," another man replied. "Blood and ashes! How long does it take to arrange a meeting with these people?"
Gaul had to duck into the tent, but Galena strode in as though entering her own rooms in the tower. A prisoner she might be, yet she was Aes Sedai, and that simple fact was a powerful tool and weapon. Who was he trying to arrange a meeting with? Not Savannah, surely. Let it be anyone but Savannah. In stark contrast to the ramshackle camp outside, there was a good flowered carpet for a floor here, and two silk hangings embroidered with flowers and birds in a Kyrianan fashion hung from the roof poles. She focused on a tall, broad-shouldered man in his shirt sleeves with his back to her, leaning on his fists against a slender-legged table that was decorated with lines of gilding and covered with maps and sheets of paper. She had only glimpsed Abara at a distance in Kyrian, yet she was sure this was the farm boy from Randall Thor's home village, in spite of the silk shirt and well-polished boots. Even the turndowns were polished. If nothing else, everyone in the tent seemed to be looking to him. As she walked into the tent, a tall woman in high-necked green silk with small touches of lace at her throat and wrists, black hair falling in waves to her shoulders, laid a hand on Abara's arm in a familiar manner. Galena recognized her.
"She seems cautious, Perrin," Berylaine said.
"Wary of a trap, in my estimation, Lord Perrin,"
put in a graying, hard-bitten man in an ornate breastplate worn over a scarlet coat.
"A Gildanin," Galena thought.
At least he and Berylaine explained the presence of soldiers, if not how they could be where they could not possibly be. Galena was very glad she had not encountered the woman in Kyrian. That would have made matters now more than merely awkward. She wished her hands were free to wipe the residue of tears from her face, but the two men held onto her arms firmly. There was nothing to be done about it. She was Aes Sedai. That was all that mattered. That was all she would allow to matter. She opened her mouth to take command of the situation. Abara suddenly looked over his shoulder at her as though he had sensed her presence in some way, and his golden eyes froze her tongue. She had dismissed tales that the man had a wolf's eyes, but he did. A wolf's hard eyes in a stone-hard face. He made the Gildanin look almost soft. A sad face behind that close-cropped beard as well. Over his wife, no doubt. She could make use of that.
"An Aes Sedai wearing Gaishine white," he said flatly, turning to face her.
He was a large man, if not nearly so large as the Aiel man, and he loomed just by standing there,
those golden eyes taking in everything. And a prisoner, it seems. She didn't want to come. She thrashed like a trout on the riverbank while Gaul was tying her up, my lord, Niald replied. Myself, I had nothing to do but stand and watch. A strange thing to say, and in such a significant tone. What could he have... Abruptly she became aware of another man in a black coat, a stocky, weathered fellow with a silver pin in the shape of a sword fastened to his high collar, and she remembered where she had last seen men in black coats. Leaping out of holes in the air just before everything turned to utter disaster at Dumai's Wells, Niald and his holes, his gateways, these men could channel. It took everything she could summon not to try jerking free of the Mirandian's clasp, not to edge away. Just being this close to him made her stomach writhe, being touched by him. She wanted to whimper, and that surprised her. Surely she was tougher than that. She concentrated on maintaining an appearance of calm while trying to work moisture back into her suddenly dry mouth. She claims friendship with Savannah, Gaul added. A friend of Savannah, Abara said, frowning, but wearing a Gaishine robe. A silk robe and jewels, but still. You didn't want to come, but you didn't channel to try stopping Gaul and Niald from bringing you, and you're terrified. He shook his head. How did he know she was afraid? I'm surprised to see an Aes Sedai with the Shido after Dumai's Wells. Or don't you know about that? Let her go, let her go. I doubt she'll take off running since she let you bring her this far. Dumai's Wells does not matter, she said coldly as the men's hands fell away. The pair remained on either side of her like guards, though, and she was proud of the steadiness of her voice. A man who could channel, two of them, and she was alone. Alone and unable to channel a thread. She stood straight, head erect. She was Aes Sedai, and they must see her every inch an Aes Sedai. How could he know she was afraid? Not a shred of fear tinged her words. Her face might as well have been carved of stone for all she let show. The White Tower has purposes none but Aes Sedai can know or understand. I am about White Tower business, and you are interfering. An unwise choice for any man. The Gildanin nodded ruefully as though he had learned that lesson personally. Abara merely looked at her, expressionless. Hearing your name was the only reason I didn't do something drastic to these two, she continued. If the Mirandian or the Aielman brought up how long that had taken, she was ready to claim that she had been stunned at first, but they held silent, and she spoke quickly and forcefully. Your wife Fael is under my protection, as well as Queen Aleandra. And when my business with Savannah is done, I will take them to safety with me and help them reach wherever they wish to go. In the meanwhile, however, your presence here endangers my business, White Tower business, which I cannot allow. It also endangers you and your wife and Aleandra. There are tens of thousands of Aiel in that camp, many tens of thousands. If they descend on you, and their scouts will find you soon if they haven't already, they will wipe all of you from the face of the earth. They may harm your wife and Aleandra for it as well. I may not be able to stop Savannah. She is a harsh woman, and many of her wise ones can channel nearly 400 of them, all willing to use the power to do violence, while I am one Aes Sedai and constrained by my oaths. If you wish to protect your wife and the queen, turn away from their camp and ride as hard as you can. They may not attack you if you are obviously retreating. That is the only hope you or your wife have. There. If only a few of the seeds she had planted took root, they should be enough to turn him back.
If Aleandra is in danger, Lord Perrin,
the Gildanin began, but Abara stopped him with a raised hand. That was all it took. The soldier's jaw tightened till she thought she might hear it creak, yet he remained silent.
You've seen Fael? The young man said, excitement touching his voice. She's well? She hasn't been harmed?
The fool seemed not to have heard a word she said beyond mention of his wife.
Well, and under my protection, Lord Perrin.
If this jumped-up country boy wanted to call himself a lord, she would tolerate it for the moment. She and Aleandra both. The soldier glowered at Abara, but he did not take the opportunity to speak.
You must listen to me,
The Shido will kill you. Come here and look at this, Ibarra broke in, turning to the table and drawing a large page toward him.
You must forgive his lack of manners, Aes Sedai,
Berilane murmured, handing her a worked silver cup of dark wine.
He is under considerable strain, as you might understand in the circumstances. I haven't introduced myself. I am Berilane, the first of Mayenne.
I know. You may call me Elise.
The other woman smiled as though she knew that was a false name, yet accepting it.
The first of Mayenne was far from unsophisticated. A pity she had to deal with the boy instead. Sophisticated people who thought they could dance with Aes Sedai were easily led. Country folk could prove stubborn out of ignorance. But the fellow should know something of Aes Sedai by now. Perhaps ignoring him would give him reason to think on who and what she was.
The wine tasted like flowers on her tongue. This is very good, she said with genuine gratitude. She had not tasted decent wine for weeks. Tharava would not permit her a pleasure the wise one denied herself. If the woman learned that she had found several barrels in Malden, she would not even have mediocre wine, and surely would be beaten as well.
There are other sisters in the camp, Elise Sedai. Masuri Sokawa and Sionid Trigon, and my own advisor, Anura Larisen.
Would you like to speak to them after you finish with Perrin?
With feigned casualness, Galena drew up her cowl till her face was shadowed and took another swallow of wine for time to think. Anura's presence was understandable, given Berilane's, but what were the other two doing there? They had been among those who fled the tower after Swan was deposed and Elida raised. True, none of them would know of her involvement in kidnapping the Owl Thor boy for Elida, but still...
I think not, she murmured. Their business is theirs and mine is mine.
She would have given a great deal to know their business, but not at the cost of being recognized.
Any friend of the Dragon Reborn might have notions about a red.
Help me convince Ibarra, Berilane. Your winged guards are no match for what the Shido will send against them. Whatever Gil'dan you have with you won't make a difference. An army will make no difference. The Shido are too many, and they have hundreds of wise ones ready to use the One Power as a weapon. I have seen them do it. You may die, too, and even if you are captured, I can't promise I can make Savannah release you when I leave. Berilane laughed, as though thousands of Shido and hundreds of wise ones who could channel were of no account.
Oh, have no fear they will find us. Their camp lies a good 3-day ride from here, perhaps 4. The terrain turns rough not far from where we are.
3 days, perhaps 4. Galena shivered. She should have put it together before this. 3 or 4 days of ground covered in less than an hour, through a hole in the air created with the male half of the power. She had been near enough for Sidene to touch her. She kept her voice steady, though.
Even so, you must help me convince him not to attack. It would be disastrous for him, for his wife, for everyone involved. Beyond that, what I am doing is important to the Tower. You have always been a strong supporter of the Tower.
Flattery for the ruler of a single city and a few hides of land, but flattery oiled the insignificant as well as it did the mighty.
Perrin is stubborn, Elise Sedai. I doubt you'll change his mind. That isn't easy to do once he has it set.
For some reason, the young woman smiled a smile mysterious enough to credit a sister.
Berilane, could you have your talk later? Ibarra said impatiently, and it was not a suggestion.
He tapped the sheet of paper with a thick finger.
Elise, would you look at this?
That was not a suggestion either. Who did the man think he was, ordering an Aes Sedai?
Still, moving to the table took her a little way from Niald. It brought her nearer the other one, who was studying her intently, but he was on the other side of the table. A feeble barrier, yet she could ignore him by looking at the sheet of paper under Ibarra's finger. Keeping her eyebrows from rising was difficult. The town of Malden was outlined there, complete with the aqueduct that brought water from a lake 5 miles away, and also a rough outline of the Shido camp surrounding the city. The real surprise was that markings seemed to indicate the arrival of septs since the Shido reached Malden, and the number of those meant his men had been observing the camp for some time.
Another map, roughly sketched, seemed to show the city itself in some detail.
"I see you have learned how large their camp is," she said. "You must know rescuing her is hopeless, even if you have 100 of those men." Speaking of them was not easy, and she could not entirely keep the contempt from her voice. "It isn't enough. Those wise ones will fight back, hundreds of them. It would be a slaughter, thousands dead, your wife perhaps among them. I have told you she and Alejandra are under my protection. When my business is finished, I will take them to safety. You have heard me say it, so by the three oaths you know it is true. Don't make the mistake of thinking that your connection to Randall Thor will protect you if you interfere in what the White Tower is doing. Yes, I know who you are. Did you think your wife wouldn't tell me? She trusts me, and if you want to keep her safe, you must trust me too." The idiot looked at her as though her words had flown over his head without touching his ears. Those eyes were truly unsettling.
"Where does she sleep? Her and everyone else who was captured with her, show me."
"I cannot," she replied levelly. "Guy Shine seldom sleep in the same place two nights running."
With that lie vanished the last chance that she could leave Fail and the others alive. Oh, she had never intended to increase the risk of her own escape by aiding them, but that could always have been explained later by some change in circumstances. She could not hazard the possibility that they might actually escape one day and uncover her direct lie, however.
"I will get her free,"
he growled, almost too softly for her to hear.
"Whatever it takes."
Her thoughts raced. There seemed no way to divert him from it, but perhaps she could delay him. She had to do at least that. "Will you at least hold off your attack? I may be able to conclude my affairs in a few more days, perhaps a week." A deadline should sharpen Fail's efforts. Before, it would have been dangerous. A threat not carried out lost all force, and the chance had been too great that the woman might be unable to get the rod in time. Now the chance became necessary. "If I can do that and bring your wife and others out, there will be no reason for you to die needlessly. 1 week." Frustration painting his face, Ebara thumped his fist on the table hard enough to make it bounce.
"You can have a few days," he growled. "Maybe even a week or more, if..."
He bit off whatever he had been about to say. Those strange eyes centered on her face.
"But I can't promise how many days," he went on. "If I had my druthers, I'd be attacking now. I won't leave Fail a prisoner a day longer than I have to, while I wait on Aes Sedai's schemes for the Shido to bear fruit. You say she's under your protection, but how great a protection can you really give wearing that robe? There are signs of drunkenness in the camp. Even some of their sentries drink. Are the wise ones given to it as well?"
The sudden shift nearly made her blink.
"The wise ones drink only water, so you needn't think you can find them all in a stupor," she told him dryly, and quite truthfully.
It always amused her when the truth served her purposes. Not that the wise one's example was bearing much fruit. Drunkenness was rife among the Shido. Every raid brought back all the wine that could be found. Dozens and dozens of small stills produced vile brews from grains, and every time the wise ones destroyed a still, two sprang up in its place. Letting him know that would only encourage him, though. "As for the others, I have been with armies before this and seen more drinking than I have among the Shido. If 100 are drunk among tens of thousands, what gain is there for you? Really, it will be better if you promised me a week. 2 would be better still." His eyes flashed the map, and his right hand made a fist again, but there was no anger in his voice.
"Do the Shido go inside the town walls very often?"
She set the wine cup down on the table and drew herself up. Meeting that yellow-eyed gaze required effort, yet she managed without a falter. "I think it's past time you showed proper respect. I am an Aes Sedai, not a servant."
"Do the Shido go inside the town walls very often?" he repeated, in exactly the same even tone. She wanted to grind her teeth.
"No," she snapped. "They've looted everything worth stealing and some things that aren't." She regretted the words as soon as they left her tongue. They had seemed safe, until she remembered men who could leap through holes in the air. "That isn't to say they never enter. Most days a few go in. There might be 20 or 30 at any time, more on occasion, in groups of 2 or 3.
Did he have the wit to see what that would mean? Best to make sure he saw. You could not secure them all. Inevitably some will escape to warn the camp. Ebara only nodded. When you see Fail, tell her that on the day she sees fog on the ridges and hears wolves howl by daylight, she and the others must go to Lady Chiron's fortress at the north end of the city and hide there. Tell her I love her. Tell her I'm coming for her. Wolves? Was the man demented? How could he ensure that wolves would... Suddenly, with those wolf's eyes on her, she was not sure she wanted to know. I will tell her, she lied. Perhaps he only meant to use the men in black coats to grab his wife? But why wait at all in that case? Those yellow eyes hid secrets she wished she knew. Who was he trying to meet? Clearly not Savannah. She would have thanked the light for that, if she had not abandoned that foolishness long since. Who was ready to come to him right away? One man had been mentioned, but that might mean a king with an army, or Althor himself. Him she prayed never to see again. Her promise seemed to release something in the young man. He exhaled slowly, and a tension she had not noticed left his face. The trouble with a blacksmith's puzzle, he said softly, tapping the outline of Malden, is always getting the key piece into place. Well, that's done. Or soon will be. Will you stay for supper? Berylaine asked. The hour is near. The light was dimming in the open doorway. A lean serving woman in dark wool, her white hair in a bun on the back of her head, entered and began lighting the lamps. Will you promise me at least a week? Galena demanded, but Ebara shook his head. In that case, every hour is important. She had never intended staying a moment longer than necessary, but she had to force her next words out. Will you have one of your men take me back to as near the camp as possible? Do it, Niald, Ebara commanded, and at least try to be polite. He said that. She drew a deep breath and pushed her cowl back. I want you to hit me. Here, she touched her cheek. Hard enough to bruise. Finally, she had said something that got through to the man. Those yellow eyes widened, and he tucked his thumbs behind his belt as though securing his hands. I will not, he said, sounding as though she were insane. The Gildanin's mouth hung open, and the serving woman was staring at her, the burning taper in her hand hanging dangerously near her skirts. I require it, Galena said firmly. She would need every scrap of verisimilitude she could find with Tharava. Do it. I don't believe he will, Berylaine said, gliding forward with her skirts gathered. He has very country ways, if you will permit me. Galena nodded impatiently. There was nothing for it, though the woman likely would not leave a very convincing. Her vision went dark, and when she could see again, she was swaying slightly. She could taste blood. Her hand went to her cheek and she winced. Too hard? Berylaine inquired anxiously. No, Galena mumbled, fighting to keep her face smooth. Had she been able to channel, she would have torn the woman's head off. Of course, if she could have channeled, none of this would be necessary. Now the other cheek, and have someone fetch my horse. She rode into the forest with the Mirandian, to a place where several of the huge trees lay toppled and oddly slashed, sure it would be difficult for her to use his hole in the air. But when the man produced a vertical silver-blue slash that widened into a view of steeply climbing land, she did not think of tainted Sidon at all as she heeled swift through the opening. Never a thought except of Tharava. She almost howled when she realized she was on the opposite side of the ridge from the encampment. Frantically she raced the sinking sun, and lost. She had been right, unfortunately. Tharava did not accept excuses. She was particularly upset over the bruises. She herself never marred Galena's face. What followed easily equaled her nightmares, and it lasted much longer. At times, when she was screaming her loudest, she almost forgot her desperate need to get the rod. But she clung to that. Obtain the rod, kill Fail and her friends, and she would be free. Egwene regained awareness slowly, and muzzy as she was, barely had the presence of mind to keep her eyes closed. Pretending still to be unconscious was all too easy. Her head lay slumped on a woman's shoulder, and she could not have lifted it had she tried. An Aes Sedai's shoulder. She could sense the woman's ability. Her brain felt stuffed with wool. Her thoughts were slow and veering, her limbs all but numb. Her wool riding dress and cloak were dry, she realized, despite the soaking she had received in the river. Well, that was easily managed with the power. Small chance they had channeled the water from her garments for her comfort, though. She was seated, wedged in between two sisters, one of whom wore a flowery perfume, each using a hand to keep her more or less upright. They were in a coach, by the way they all swayed, and the clatter of a trotting team's horseshoes on paving stones. Carefully she opened her eyes to narrow slits. The coach's side curtains were tied back, though the stink of rotting garbage made her think it would have been better to pull them shut. Garbage? Rotting? How could Tar Valon have come to that? Such neglect of the city was reason enough by itself for Elida to be removed. The windows let in enough moonlight for her to dimly make out three Aes Sedai seated facing her in the rear of the coach. Even had she not known they could channel, their fringed shawls would have made it certain. In Tar Valon, wearing a shawl with fringe could result in unpleasantness for a woman who was not Aes Sedai. Oddly, the sister on the left appeared to be huddling against the side of the coach, away from the other two. And if they were not exactly huddling, at least they were sitting very close together, as though avoiding contact with the third Aes Sedai. Very odd. Abruptly it came to her that she was not shielded. Muddled she might be, but that made no sense at all. They could feel her strength as she could theirs, and while none was weak, she thought she could overcome all five if she were quick enough. The true source was a vast sun just beyond the edge of sight, calling to her. The first question was, did she dare try yet? In the state her head was, thought wading through knee-deep mud, whether she could actually embrace Sidar was uncertain, and succeed or fail they would know once she tried. Best to try recovering a little beforehand. The second question was, how long did she dare wait? They would not let her go unshielded forever. Experimentally, she tried wiggling her toes inside her stout leather shoes, and was delighted when they moved obediently. Life seemed to be returning slowly to her arms and legs. She thought she might be able to raise her head now, if unsteadily. Whatever they had given her was wearing off. How long? Events were taken out of her hands by the dark-haired sister sitting in the middle of the rear seat, who leaned forward and slapped her so hard that she toppled onto the lap of the woman she had been leaning against. Her hand went to her stinging cheek on its own volition. So much for pretending unconsciousness.
"There was no need for that, Katerina," a raspy voice said above her as its owner lifted her upright again.
She could hold her head up, just, it turned out. Katerina. That would be Katerina Alruddin, a Red. It seemed important to identify her captors for some reason, though she knew nothing of Katerina beyond her name and Aja. The sister she had fallen onto was yellow-haired, but her moon-shadowed face belonged to a stranger.
"I think you gave her too much of the fork root," the woman went on.
A chill flashed through her. So that was what she had been fed. She racked her brain for everything Nynaeve had told her about that vile tea, but her thoughts were still slow. Better, though, it seemed. She was sure Nynaeve had said the effects took some time to go away completely.
"I gave her the exact dose, Phelana,"
the sister who had slapped her replied dryly.
"And as you can see, it is leaving her precisely as it should. I want her able to walk by the time we reach the tower. I certainly don't intend to help carry her again," she finished, with a glare for the sister seated to Egwene's left, who shook her head, beaded braids clicking faintly. That was Pratala Nurbaijan, a yellow who had done her best to avoid teaching novices or accepted, and made little secret of her dislike for the task when forced to it.
"To have my Harrel carry her, it would have been improper, yes?" she said coldly. In fact, icily. "Myself I will be glad if she can walk, but if not, so be it. In any case, I look forward to handing her over to others. If you do not want to carry her again, Katerina, I do not want to stand guard over her half the night in the cells.
Katerina gave a dismissive toss of her head.
The cells.
Of course, she was bound for one of those small dark rooms on the first level of the tower's basement. Elida would charge her with falsely claiming to be the Ammerlin's seat. The penalty for that was death. Strangely, that brought no fear. Perhaps it was the herb working on her. Would Romanda or Lelaine give way, agreeing to be raised Ammerlin after she was dead? Or would they continue to struggle with one another until the entire rebellion faltered and failed and the sisters straggled back to Elida? A sad thought, that. Bone-deep sad. But if she could feel sorrow, the fork root was not quenching her emotions. So why was she not afraid? She thumbed her great serpent ring. At least she tried to, and discovered it gone. Anger flared, white hot. They might kill her, but they would not deny she was Aes Sedai. "Who betrayed me?" she asked, pleased that her tone was even and cool. "It can't hurt to tell me, since I'm your prisoner." The sisters stared at her as though surprised she had a voice. Katerina leaned forward casually, raising her hand. The red's eyes tightened when pale-haired Falana lunged to catch the slap before it could land on Egwene.
"She will no doubt be executed," the raspy-voiced woman said firmly. "But she is an initiate of the Tower, and none of us has the right to beat her." "Take your hand off me, Brown!"
Katerina snarled, and shockingly the light of Sidar enveloped her. In an instant the glow surrounded every woman on the coach except Egwene. They eyed one another like strange cats on the brink of hissing, on the brink of lashing out with claws. No, not everyone. Katerina and the taller sisters, seated against her flank, never glanced at one another, but they had glares aplenty for the rest. What under the light was going on? The mutual hostility was so thick in the air she could have sliced it like bread. After a moment, Falana released Katerina's wrist and leaned back, yet no one released the source. Egwene suddenly suspected that no one was willing to be the first. Their faces were all serene in the pale moonlight, but the brown's hands were knotted in her shawl, and the sister leaning away from Katerina was smoothing her skirts repeatedly.
"About time for this, I think," Katerina said, weaving a shield. "We wouldn't want you to try anything futile."
Her smile was vicious. Egwene merely sighed as the weave settled on her. She doubted she could have embraced Sidar yet in any case. And against five already full of the power, success would have lasted moments at most. Her mild reaction appeared to disappoint the Red.
"This may be your last night in the world," she went on. "It wouldn't surprise me in the slightest if Elida had you stilled and beheaded tomorrow." "Or even tonight," her lanky companion added, nodding. "I think Elida may be that eager to see the end of you."
Unlike Katerina, she was merely stating a fact. But she was surely another Red, and watching the other sisters, as though she suspected one of them might try something. This was very strange. Egwene held on to her composure, denying them the response they wanted. The response Katerina wanted, at least. She was determined to maintain her dignity right to the headsman's block. Whether or not she had managed to do well as Ammerlin, she would die in a manner fitting for the Ammerlin seat. The woman huddling away from the two Reds spoke, and her voice, full of Arafel, allowed Egwene to put a name to the hard, narrow face, dimly seen by moonlight. Barisha Terakuni, a grey with a reputation for the strictest and often harshest interpretation of the law, always to the letter, of course, but never with any sense of mercy.
"Not tonight or tomorrow, Barisine. Not unless Elida is willing to summon the sitters in the middle of the night, and they're willing to answer. This requires a high court, no thing of minutes or even hours, and the hall seems less eager to please Elida than she might wish, small wonder. The girl will be tried, but the hall will sit in the matter when they choose, I think."
"The hall will come when Elida calls, or she'll hand them all penances that will make them wish they had," Katerina sneered. "The way Jala and Merim galloped off when we saw who we'd caught, she knows by now. And I'll wager that for this one Elida will drag sitters from their beds with her own hands if she must."
Her voice grew smug and cutting at the same time. "Perhaps she will name you to the chair of pardon. Would you enjoy that?" Berisha drew herself up indignantly, shifting her shawl on her arms. In some instances, the chair of pardon faced the same penalty as the one she defended. Perhaps this charge required it. Despite Swan's best efforts to complete her education, Egwene did not know.
"What I want to hear," the Grey said after a moment, ostentatiously ignoring the women on the seat with her, "is what did you do to the harbor chain? How can it be undone?"
"It can't be undone," Egwene replied. "You must know that it's Quain D'Ar now. Even the power won't break it, only strengthen it. I suppose you could sell it if you tear down enough of the harbor wall to remove it. If anyone can afford a piece of Quain D'Ar that big, or would want such a thing." This time no one tried to stop Katerina from slapping her, and very hard, too.
"Hold your tongue," the Red snapped.
That seemed good advice, unless she wanted to be slapped silly. She could taste blood in her mouth already. So Egwene held her tongue, and silence descended on the rolling coach, the others all glowing with Sidar and watching each other suspiciously. It was incredible. Why had Elida ever chosen women who clearly detested one another for tonight's task? As a demonstration of her power? Just because she could? No matter. If Elida allowed her to live through this night, at least she could let Swan know what had happened to her, and likely to Lyanna as well. She could let Swan know they had been betrayed, and pray that Swan could track down the betrayer, pray that the rebellion would not collapse. She offered a small prayer for that on the spot. It was much more important than the other. By the time the coachman reined in the team, she had recovered enough to follow Katerina and Pertalla from the coach unaided, though her head still felt a trifle thick. She could stand, but she doubted she had the strength to run far, not that trying would achieve anything beyond being halted after a few steps. So she stood calmly beside the dark lacquered coach and waited as patiently as the four-horse team in their harness. After all, she was harnessed too, in a manner of speaking. The white tower loomed over them, a thick pale shaft rearing into the night. Few of its windows were alight, but some of those were near the very top, perhaps in the rooms Elida occupied. It was very strange. She was a prisoner and unlikely to live much longer, yet she felt she had come home. The tower seemed to renew her vigor. Two tower-liveried backriders, the flame of Tar Valon on their chests, had dismounted from the rear of the coach to unfold the steps, and they stood offering a white-gloved hand to each woman who dismounted, but only Berisha availed herself, and only because it let her reach the paving stones quickly while eyeing the other sisters, Egwene suspected. Barasine gave the fellows such looks that one gulped audibly and the other's face grew pale. Falana, busy trying to watch the others, merely waved the men away irritably. All five still held Sidar, even here. They were at the main rear entrance, stone-railed marble stairs descending from the second level beneath four massive bronze lanterns that cast a wide pool of flickering light. And, to her surprise, a single novice stood alone at the foot of the stairs, clutching her white cloak against a slight chill in the air. She had more than half expected Elida to meet them in person, to gloat over her capture with a retinue of sycophants. That the novice was Nicola Treehill was a second surprise. The last place she would have thought to find the runaway was inside the White Tower itself. By the way Nicola's eyes widened when Egwene emerged from the coach, the novice was more startled than herself, but she dropped a neat if hasty curtsy to the sisters.
"The Ammerlin says she is to be handed over to the Mistress of Novices, Katerina Sedai. She says that Sylviana Sedai has her instructions."
"So it seems you'll be birched tonight, at least," Katerina murmured with a smile. Egwene wondered whether the woman hated her personally, or for what she represented, or simply hated everyone. Birched. She had never seen it done, but she had heard a description. It sounded extremely painful.
She met Katerina's gaze levelly, and after a moment the smile faded. The woman looked about to strike her again.
The Aiel had a way of dealing with pain. They embraced it,
gave themselves over to it without fighting or even trying to hold back screams, perhaps that would help. The wise one said that way the pain could be cast off without keeping its hold on you.
"If Elida means to drag this out unnecessarily, I'll have no more part in it tonight,"
Phelana announced, frowning at everyone in sight, including Nicola.
"If the girl is to be stilled and executed, that should be sufficient."
Gathering her skirts, the yellow-haired sister darted past Nicola up the stairs, actually running. The glow of Sidar still surrounded her as she vanished inside.
"I agree," Pretella said coolly. "Harrel, I think I'll walk with you while you stable Bloodlance."
A dark, stocky man who had come out of the darkness leading a tall bay bowed to her. Stone-faced, he wore a warder's chameleon cloak that made most of him seem not to be there when he stood still, and rippled with colors when he moved. Silently he followed Pretella off into the night, but watching over his shoulder, guarding Pretella's back. The light remained around her, too. There was something here that Egwene was missing. Suddenly Nicola spread her skirts in another curtsy, deeper this time, and words burst out of her in a rush.
"I'm sorry I ran away, Mother. I thought they'd let me go faster here. Arena and I thought—"
"Don't call her that!"
Katarina barked, and a switch of air caught the novice across the bottom hard enough to make her squeal and jump.
"If you're attending the Ammerlin seat tonight, child, get back to her and tell her I said her orders will be carried out. Now run!"
With one last frantic glance at Egwene, Nicola gathered her cloak and her skirts and went scrambling up the stairs so fast that twice she stumbled and nearly fell. Poor Nicola. Her hopes had surely been disappointed, and if the tower discovered her age, she must have lied about that to be taken in. Lying was one of her several bad habits. Egwene dismissed the girl from her mind. Nicola was no longer her concern.
"There was no need to frighten the child out of her wits," Barisha said surprisingly. "Novices need to be guided, not bludgeoned." A far cry from her views on the law.
Katarina and Barasine rounded on the grey together, staring at her intently. Only two cats now, but rather than another cat, they saw a mouse.
"Do you mean to come with us to Sylviana alone?"
Katarina asked, with a decidedly unpleasant smile twisting her lips.
"Aren't you afraid, Grey?"
Barasine said, a touch of mockery in her voice. For some reason she swung one arm a little so the long fringe of her shawl swayed.
"Just the one of you and two of us?"
The two back riders stood like statues, like men who desired heartily to be anywhere else and hoped to remain unnoticed, if sufficiently still. Barisha was no taller than Egwene, but she drew herself up and clutched her shawl around her.
"Threats are specifically prohibited by Tower—"
"Did Barasine threaten you?" Katarina cut in softly. Softly, yet with sharp steel wrapped in it. "She just asked whether you are afraid. Should you be?" Barisha licked her lips uneasily. Her face was bloodless, and her eyes grew wider and wider as though she saw things she had no wish to see.
I think I will take a walk in the grounds," she said at last in a strangled voice,
and sidled away without ever taking her eyes from the two reds. Katarina gave a small, satisfied laugh.
This was absolute madness.
Even sisters who hated one another to the toenails did not behave in this fashion. No woman who gave in to fear as easily as Barisha had could ever have become Aes Sedai in the first place. Something was wrong in the tower. Very wrong.
"Bring her," Katarina said, starting up the stairs.
At last, releasing Sidar, Barasine gripped Egwene's arm tightly and followed. There was no choice save to gather her divided skirts and go along without a struggle. Yet her spirits were oddly buoyant. Entering the tower truly did feel like returning home. The white walls with their friezes and tapestries, the brightly colored floor tiles, seemed as familiar as her mother's kitchen. More so, in a way. It had been far longer since she saw her mother's kitchen than these hallways. She took in the strength of home with every breath. But there was strangeness, too. The stand lamps were all alight,
and the hour could not be all that late, yet she saw no one. There were always a few sisters gliding along the corridors, even in the dead of night. She remembered that vividly, catching sight of some sister while running on an errand in the small hours, and despairing that she would ever be so graceful, so queenly. Aes Sedai kept their own hours, and some Browns hardly liked being awake during daylight at all. Night held fewer distractions from their studies, fewer interruptions to their reading, but there was no one. Neither Katerina nor Barrasine made any comment as they walked along hallways lifeless except for the three of them. Apparently this silent emptiness was a matter of course now. As they reached pale stone stairs set in an alcove, another sister finally appeared, climbing from below. A plump woman in a red-slashed riding dress, with a mouth that looked ready to smile, she wore her shawl, edged with long red silk fringe, draped along her arms. Katerina and the others might well have worn theirs to mark them out clearly at the docks. No one in Tarvalen would bother a woman wearing a fringed shawl, and most kept clear if they could, particularly men. But why here? The newcomer's thick black eyebrows raised over bright blue eyes at the sight of Egwene, and she planted her fists on ample hips, letting her shawl slide to her elbows. Egwene did not think she had ever seen the woman before, but apparently the reverse was not true. "Why, that's the Alvear girl. They sent her to South Harbor? Elida will give you a pretty for this night's work. Yes, she will. But look at her. Look at how she stands so. You'd think the pair of you were an honor guard for escort. I'd have thought she'd be weeping and wailing for mercy." "I believe the herb is still dulling her senses," Katerina muttered with a sidelong scowl for Egwene. "She doesn't seem to realize her situation." Barrasine, still holding Egwene's arm, gave her a vigorous shake. But after a small stagger, she managed to catch her balance and kept her face smooth, ignoring the taller woman's glares. "In shock," the plump red said, nodding. She did not sound exactly sympathetic, but after Katerina she was near enough.
"I've seen that before."
"How did matters go at North Harbor, Millaire?" Barrasine asked.
"Not so well as with you, it seems. With everyone else squealing to themselves like shoats caught under a fence over there being two of us, I was afraid we'd scare off who we were trying to catch. It's a good thing there were two of us who would talk to one another. As it was, all we caught was a Wilder, and not before she turned half the harbor chain to Quendi Yar. We ended up near killing the coach horses by galloping back like we caught your prize. Zanika insisted. Even put her warder up in place of the coachman."
"A Wilder," Katerina said contemptuously. "Only half?" Relief stood out clearly in Barrasine's voice. "Then North Harbor isn't blocked." Malaire's eyebrows climbed again as the implications sank in.
"We'll see how clear it is in the morning," she said slowly, "when they let down the half that's still iron. The rest of it stands out stiff like a bar of Quendi Yar. Myself, I doubt any but smaller vessels will be able to cross."
She shook her head with a puzzled expression.
"There was something strange, though, more than strange. We couldn't find the Wilder at first. We couldn't feel her channeling. There was no glow around her, and we couldn't see her weaves. The chain just started turning white. If Arabis's warder hadn't spotted the boat, she might have finished and gotten away."
"Clever, Lyanna," Egwene murmured. For an instant, she squeezed her eyes shut. Lyanna had prepared everything in advance before coming in sight of the harbor, all inverted and her ability masked. If she herself had been as clever, she likely would have escaped cleanly. But then hindsight always saw farthest.
"That's the name she gave," Malaire said, frowning.
The woman's eyebrows, like dark caterpillars, were very expressive.
"Lyanna Sheriff, of the Green Aja. Two very stupid lies. Dasala is striping her from top to bottom down there, but she won't budge. I had to come up for a breath. I never liked flogging, even for one like that. Do you know this trick of hers, child, how to hide your weaves?"
Oh, light. They thought Lyanna was a Wilder pretending to be Aes Sedai. She's telling the truth. Stilling cost her the ageless look and made her appear younger. She was healed by Nynaeve Almira, and since she was no longer of the blue, she chose a new Aja,
ask her questions only Liana Sheriff could know the answers. Speech ended for her as a ball of air filled her mouth, forcing her jaws wide till they creaked.
"We don't have to listen to this nonsense," Katerina growled.
Malaire stared into Egwene's eyes, though.
"It sounds senseless, to be sure," she said after a moment. "But I suppose it wouldn't hurt to ask a few questions besides, what is your name? At worst, it'll cut the tedium of the woman's answers. Should we take her down to the cells, Katerina? I don't dare leave Dasala alone with the other one for long. She despises Wilders, and she purely hates women who claim to be Aes Sedai."
"She's not going to the cells yet," Katerina replied. "Elida wants her taken to Sylviana.
Well, as long as I learn that trick from this child or the other one."
Hitching her shawl up onto her shoulders, Malaire took a deep breath and headed back down the stairs, a woman with labor ahead of her she was not looking forward to. She gave Egwene hope for Liana, though. Liana was the other one now, no longer the Wilder. Katerina set off down the corridor, walking quickly and in silence, but Barrasine pushed Egwene ahead of her after the other read, muttering half under her breath about how ridiculous it was to think that a sister could learn anything from a Wilder or from a jumped-up accepted who told outlandish lies. Maintaining some shreds of dignity was difficult, to say the least, while being shoved down a hallway by a long-legged woman, with your mouth gaping open as wide as it would go and drool leaking down your chin, but she managed as best she could. In truth, she hardly thought about it. Malaire had given her too much to think on. Malaire added to the sisters in the coach. It could hardly mean what it seemed to, but if it did. Soon the blue and white floor tiles became red and green, and they approached an unmarked wooden door between two tapestries of flowered trees and stout-beaked birds, so colorful they seemed unlikely to be real. Unmarked, but bright with polish, and known to every initiate of the tower. Katerina rapped on the door with what might almost have been a display of diffidence, and when a strong voice inside called, "Come," she drew a deep breath before pushing the door open. Did she have bad memories of entering here as novice or accepted? Or was it the woman who awaited them who made her hesitant? The study of the Mistress of Novices was exactly as Egwene recalled, a small, dark-paneled room with plain, sturdy furnishings. A narrow table by the doorway was lightly carved in a peculiar pattern, and bits of gilt clung to the carved frame of the mirror on one wall, but nothing else was decorated in any way. The stand lamps and the pair of lamps on the writing table were unadorned brass, though of six different patterns. The woman who held the office usually changed when a new Amarlin was raised, yet Egwene was ready to wager that a woman who had come to this room as a novice 200 years ago would recognize nearly every stick, and perhaps everything. The current Mistress of Novices, in the tower at least, was on her feet when they entered, a stocky woman nearly as tall as Barrasine, with a dark bun on the back of her head and a square, determined chin. There was an air of brooking no nonsense about Sylviana Brayan. She was a red, and her charcoal-colored skirts had discreet red slashes, but her shawl lay draped across the back of the chair behind the writing table. Her large eyes were unsettling, however. They seemed to take in everything about Egwene in a glance, as though the woman not only knew every thought in her head, but also what she would think tomorrow.
"Leave her with me, and wait outside," Sylviana said in a low, firm voice.
"Leave her?" Katerina said incredulously.
"Which words did you not understand, Katerina? Need I repeat myself?"
Apparently she did not. Katerina flushed, but she said no more. The glow of Sidar surrounded Sylviana, and she took over the shield smoothly, without giving any opening when Egwene might have embraced the power herself. She was certain that she could now. Except that Sylviana was far from weak, there was no hope she could break the woman's shield. The gag of air disappeared at the same time, and she contented herself with digging a handkerchief from her belt pouch and calmly wiping her chin. The pouch had been searched. She always kept the handkerchief on top, not beneath everything else, but learning whether anything besides her ring had been taken would have to wait. There had not been anything of much use to a prisoner in any case. A comb, a packet of needles, some small scissors, odds and ends. The Ammerlins stole. What sort of dignity she could maintain while being birched was beyond her, but that was the future. This was now. Sylviana studied her, arms folded beneath her breasts, until the door closed behind the other two Reds.
"You aren't hysterical, at least," she said then. "That makes matters easier. But why aren't you hysterical?"
"Would it do any good?" Egwene replied, returning the handkerchief to her pouch. "I can't see how." Sylviana strode to the writing table and stood reading from a sheet of paper there, occasionally glancing up. Her expression was a perfect mask of Aes Sedai serenity, unreadable. Egwene waited patiently, hands folded at her waist. Even upside down, she could recognize Elida's distinctive hand on that page, if not read what it said. The woman need not think she would grow nervous at waiting. Patience was one of the few weapons left to her at present.
"It seems the Ammerlin has been mulling over what to do about you for some time," Sylviana said finally.
If she had expected Egwene to begin shifting her feet or wringing her hands, she gave no sign of disappointment.
"She has a very complete plan ready. She doesn't want the tower to lose you. Nor do I. Elida has decided that you have been used as a dupe by others and should not be held accountable. So you will not be charged with claiming to be Ammerlin. She has stricken your name from the roll of the accepted and entered it in the novice book again. I agree with that decision, frankly, though it's never been done before. Whatever your ability with the power, you missed almost everything else you should have learned as a novice. You needn't fear that you'll have to take the test again, though. I wouldn't force anyone to go through that twice.
I am Aes Sedai by virtue of having been raised to the Ammerlin seat, Egwene replied calmly. There was no incongruity in fighting for a title when claiming it might still lead to her death. Acquiescence would be as sharp a blow to the rebellion as her execution, maybe sharper. A novice again? That was laughable. I can cite the relevant passages in the law if you wish. Sylviana arched an eyebrow and sat down to open a large leather-bound book, the Punishments book. Dipping her pen in the simple glass ink jar, she made a notation.
You've just earned your first visit to me. I'll give you the night to think about it rather than putting you over my knee now. Let's hope contemplation increases the salubrious effect.
Do you think you can make me deny who I am with a spanking? Egwene was hard put to keep incredulity from her voice. She was not sure she succeeded.
There are spankings and spankings, the other woman replied. Wiping the nib clean on a scrap, she replaced the pen in its glass holder and considered Egwene. You're accustomed to Shiriam Bayanar as mistress of novices. Sylviana shook her head disparagingly. I've browsed her punishments book. She let the girls get away with too much and was far too lenient with her favorites. As a result, she was forced to deal out correction much more often than she should have had to. I record a third of the punishments in a month that Shiriam did because I make sure that everyone I punish leaves here wishing above all things never to be sent to me again. Whatever you do, you'll never make me deny who I am, Egwene said firmly. How can you possibly think you can make this work? Am I to be escorted to classes, shielded all the while? Sylviana leaned back against her shawl, resting her hands on the edge of the table. You mean to resist as long as you can, do you?
I will do what I must,
and I will do what I must. During the day you will not be shielded at all, but every hour you will be given a mild tincture of fork root.
Sylviana's mouth twisted on the word. She picked up the sheet that contained Elida's notes as if to read, then let it drop back onto the tabletop, rubbing her fingertips as though something noxious clung to them.
I cannot like this stuff. It seems aimed directly at Aes Sedai. Someone who cannot channel can drink 5 times the amount that makes a sister pass out and barely grow dizzy from it. A disgusting brew. Yet useful, it seems. Perhaps it can be used on those Ashaman.
The tincture won't make you dizzy, but you won't be able to channel enough to cause any problems. Only trickles.
Refuse to drink, and it will be poured down your throat anyway. You'll be closely watched as well, so you don't try to slip away afoot. At night you will be shielded, since giving you enough fork root to make you sleep through the night would leave you doubled up with stomach cramps the next day. You are a novice, Egwene, and you will be a novice. Many sisters still consider you a runaway, no matter what orders Swan Sanche gave, and others doubtless will think Elida wrong not to have you beheaded. They'll watch for every infraction, every fault. You may sneer at a spanking now before you've received it, but when you're being sent to me for 5, 6, 7 every day, we'll see how long it takes you to change your mind. Egwene surprised herself by giving a small laugh, and Sylviana's eyebrows shot up. Her hand twitched as though to reach for her pen. "Did I say something funny, child?"
"Not at all," Egwene replied truthfully. It had occurred to her that she could deal with the pain by embracing it in the Aiel manner.
She hoped it worked, but there went all hope for dignity, while she was being punished at least. For the rest, she could only do what she could. Sylviana glanced at her pen, but finally stood without touching it.
"Then I am done with you, for tonight. I will see you before breakfast, however. Come with me."
She started for the door, confident that Egwene would follow, and Egwene did. Attacking the other woman physically would achieve no more than another entry in the book. Fork root. Well, she would find a way around that somehow. If not, she refused to think about that. Katerina and Barasine were startled, to say the least, at hearing Elida's plans for Egwene, and not best pleased to learn that they would be watching her and shielding her while she slept, although Sylviana told them she would arrange for other sisters to come after an hour or two. "Why both of us?" Katerina wanted to know, which earned her a wry glance from Barasine. If only one were sent, it surely would not be Katerina, who stood higher.
"Firstly, because I said so."
Sylviana waited until the other two reds nodded in acceptance. They did so with obvious reluctance, but not enough to make her wait long. She had not put on her shawl to come into the hallway, and in some odd fashion she seemed the one out of place.
"And secondly, because this child is tricky, I think. I want her watched carefully, awake or asleep. Which of you has her ring?"
After a moment, Barasine produced the circle of gold from her belt pouch, muttering, "I only thought to keep it as a memento of the rebels being brought to heel. They're finished now, for sure."
"A memento? It was stealing, was what it was."
Egwene reached for the ring, but Sylviana's hand got there first, and it was into her pouch that the ring went.
"I'll keep this until you have the right to wear it again, child. Now take her to the novices' quarters and settle her in. A room should have been prepared by now."
Katerina resumed the shield, and Barasine reached for Egwene's arm again, but Egwene stretched out a hand toward Sylviana.
"Wait. There's something I must tell you."
She had agonized over this. It would be all too easy to reveal far more than she wanted, but she had to do it. "I have the talent of dreaming. I've learned to tell the true dreams, and to interpret some of them. I dreamt of a glass lamp that burned with a white flame. Two ravens flew out of mist, struck the lamp, and flew on. The lamp wobbled, flinging off droplets of flaming oil. Some of those burned up in midair, others landed scattered about, and the lamp still wobbled on the edge of falling. It means the Shanshan will attack the White Tower and do great harm."
Barasine sniffed. Katerina gave a derisive snort. "A dreamer," Sylviana said flatly. "Is there anyone who can back up your claim? And if there is, how can you be sure your dream means the Shanshan? Ravens would indicate the shadow to me."
"I'm a dreamer, and when a dreamer knows, she knows. Not the shadow, the Shanshan.
As for who knows what I can do," Egwene shrugged. "The only one you can reach is Lyanna Sharif, who's being held in the cells below."
She saw no way to bring the wise ones into this, not without revealing entirely too much.
"That woman is a wilder, not—"
Katerina began angrily, but her mouth snapped shut when Sylviana raised a peremptory hand.
The mistress of novices studied Egwene carefully, her face still an unreadable mask of calmness.
"You truly believe you are what you say," she said finally. "I do hope your dreaming won't cause as many problems as young Nicola's foretelling, if you truly can dream. Well, I will pass along your warning. I can't see how the Shanshan could strike at us here in Tarvalen, but watchfulness never hurts, and I'll question this woman being held below, carefully. And if she fails to back up your tale, then your visit to me in the morning will be even more memorable for you."
She waved her hand at Katerina.
"Take her away before she hands me another nugget and keeps me from getting any sleep at all tonight."
This time Katerina muttered as much as Barrasine. But they both waited until they were beyond earshot of Sylviana. That woman was going to be a formidable opponent. Egwene hoped embracing pain worked as well as the wise ones claimed. Otherwise did not bear thinking about. A lean, gray-haired serving woman gave them directions to the room she had just finished making up, on the third gallery of the novices' quarters, and hurried on after brief curtsies to the two reds. She never so much as glanced at Egwene. What was another novice to her? It tightened Egwene's jaw. She was going to have to make people not see her as just another novice.
"Look at her face," Barrasine said. "I think it's finally settling in on her."
"I am who I am," Egwene replied calmly. Barrasine pushed her toward the stairs that rose through the hollow column of railed galleries, lit by the fat, waning moon. A breeze sighed through, the only sound. It all seemed so peaceful. There was no light showing around any door. The novices would be asleep by now, except for those who had late chores or tasks. It was peaceful for them. Not for Egwene, though. The tiny windowless room might almost have been the one she had occupied when she first came to the tower, with its narrow bed built against the wall and a small fire burning on the little brick hearth. The lamp on the small table was lit, but it lighted little more than the tabletop, and the oil must have gone bad because it gave off a faint, unpleasant stink. A washstand completed the furnishings except for a three-legged stool, onto which Katerina promptly lowered herself, adjusting her skirts as though on a throne. Realizing there was nowhere for her to sit, Barrasine crossed her arms beneath her breasts and frowned at Egwene. The room was quite crowded with three women in it, but Egwene pretended the other two did not exist as she readied herself for bed, hanging her cloak and belt and dress on three of the pegs set along one rough plastered white wall. She did not ask for help with her buttons. By the time she laid her neatly rolled stockings atop her shoes, Barrasine had settled herself cross-legged on the floor and was immersed in a small leather-bound book that she must have carried in her belt pouch. Katerina kept her eyes on Egwene as though she expected her to make a break for the door. Crawling beneath the light woolen blanket in her shift, Egwene settled her head on the small pillow, not a goose-down pillow, that was for sure, and went through the exercises, relaxing her body one part at a time that would put her to sleep. She had done that so often that it seemed no sooner had she begun than she was asleep, and floating, formless, in a darkness that lay between the waking world and Telaranriod, the narrow gap between dream and reality, a vast void filled with a myriad of twinkling specks of light that were all the dreams of all the sleepers in the world. They floated around her, in this place with no up or down, as far as the eye could see, flickering out as a dream ended, springing alight as one began. She could recognize some at sight, put a name to the dreamer, but she did not see the one she sought. It was to Swan she needed to speak. Swan, who likely knew by now that disaster had struck, who might be unable to sleep until exhaustion took her under. She settled herself to wait. There was no sense of time here. She would not grow bored with waiting. But she had to work out what to say. So much had changed since she wakened. She had learned so much. Then she had been sure she would die soon, sure the sisters inside the tower were a solid army behind Elida. Now, Elida thought her safely imprisoned. No matter this talk of making her a novice again, even if Elida really believed it, Egwene Alvear did not. She did not consider herself a prisoner, either. She was carrying the battle into the heart of the tower itself. If she had had lips there, she would have smiled. Chapter 1. When Last Sounds. The wheel of time turns and ages come and pass, leaving memories that become legend. Legend fades to myth, and even myth is long forgotten when the age that gave it birth comes again. In one age, called the Third Age, by some an age yet to come, an age long past, a wind rose above the broken mountain named Dragon Mount. The wind was not the beginning. There are neither beginnings nor endings to the turning of the wheel of time. But it was a beginning. Born beneath the glow of a fat, sinking moon, at an altitude where men could not breathe, born among writhing currents, heated by the fires inside the ragged peak, the wind was a zephyr in the beginning, yet it gained in strength as it rushed down the steep, rugged slope. Carrying ash and the stench of burning sulfur from the heights, the wind roared across the sudden snowy hills that reared from the plains surrounding the impossible height of Dragon Mount, roared and tossed trees in the night. Eastward out of the hills the wind howled, across a large pasture encampment, a considerable village of tents and wooden walkways lining streets of frozen ruts. Soon enough the ruts would melt, and the last of the snow vanish, replaced by spring rains and mud, if the encampment remained that long. Despite the hour, many among the Aes Sedai were awake, gathered in small groups, warded against eavesdropping, discussing what had transpired this night. No few of those discussions were quite animated, little short of argument, and some held undeniable heat. Fists might have been shaken or worse, had they not belonged to Aes Sedai. What to do next was the question. Every sister knew the news from the riverbank by now, if the details remained sketchy. The Amyrlin herself had gone in secret to seal South Harbor, and her boat had been found overturned and caught in the reeds. Survival in the swift, icy currents of the Erinin was unlikely, and hour by hour it had become more so until certainty hardened. The Amyrlin seat was dead. Every sister in the camp knew that her future and perhaps her life hung by a thread, not to mention the future of the White Tower itself. What to do now? Yet voices fell silent, and heads came up as the fierce blast struck the camp, fluttering tent canvas like flags, pelting it with clods of snow. The sudden stink of burning sulfur hung heavy in the air, announcing where that wind had come from, and more than one Aes Sedai offered a silent prayer against evil. In moments, though, the wind had passed, and the sisters bent back to their deliberations on a future bleak enough to fit the sharp, fading stench left behind.